Welcome to the Reason Roundtable, the 1 hour of your week you won't be panicking about your crypto wallet. I am Matt Welch, joined by Nick Gillespie, Peter Suderman, and Catherine Mangyu Ward. Good morning, First Sergeants.
Hi, Matt.
Howdy, friend.
Happy Monday.
We are going to talk about what we learned at the January 6th committee hearing in a moment. But first, even fancy health insurance policies typically do not cover the cost of being airlifted to a medical facility during an emergency. That's where AirMed Care Network steps in. When you join the AirMed Care Network, if you find yourself in such need, you will not see a bill for air transport when flown by a participating AMCN provider. This peace of mind for your entire household can be yours, beginning at the low, low price of $85 a year. AMCN helps transport more than 100,000 patients per year. That means on average more than 10 during this very episode of the Reason Roundtable podcast. Speaking of which, those of you who signed up right now for that protection will receive a gift card from Visa or Amazon worth up to $50. Just visit airmedcarenetwork.com/reason. Use the offer code REASON and get you some of that peace of mind for your family. Please visit airmedcarenetwork.com/reason today. You'll be glad you did. All right. On Thursday night, about 20 million Americans tuned into the first installment of the primetime January 6th Select Committee hearings, defying at least some expectations, like mine. The presentation was not dominated by camera-hogging speechifying by various members, but was instead a largely sober and sobering prosecutorial brief in which Liz Cheney, in particular, laid out how former President Donald Trump's own inner circle considered his Stop the Steal claims of election fraud to be, in the phrasing of former Attorney General Bill Barr, cover your ears, kids, bullshit. Also, how it was Vice President Mike Pence and not the Commander-in-Chief who, during that siege on the Capitol, put in phone calls and orders to all the relevant military and law enforcement bodies, and how Trump, reportedly, when told that rioters were chanting, "Hang Mike Pence," said, "Maybe our supporters have the right idea. Maybe Mike Pence deserves it." Trump denies that and many other claims from the hearing. Catherine, let's start with you for a change. What was your impression of and reaction to that first hearing?
So I actually did not tune in to the hearing because I came in with what I suspect your same attitude, which was this is going to be a bunch of garbage bloviating. That does tend to be what Congress gets up to, broadly speaking. The following morning, the Washington Post had, you know, I get their morning email, and the Washington Post had 11 stories about the hearing, which is more than any news story that has ever occurred in the history of the Washington Post. So I did have this kind of initial stance, which was this is going to be a waste of time and it's going to be showboating, and it's going to be showboating not just by Congress, but also by the press that desperately want this to be somehow still the thing that brings Donald Trump down, when I had long since lost hope that there is anything that is the thing that brings Donald Trump down.
I'm pretty sure, though, we're going to vote him out of office in 2024.
You know, it's not clear, Nick. I mean, truly, like he does seem to keep popping back up and mattering, not least because The Washington Post writes 11 stories about whether or not he matters on a morning after a hearing. I did like Elizabeth Nolan Brown's take on it in the roundup the following day, which was like, hey, actually, I learned some stuff. There was some substance here. We'll keep an eye on it. I will flag, though I don't need to go into it right now, I really don't like the word sedition, and we should not use it basically ever, and certainly not about these people. They did plenty of bad things that we can discuss and potentially punish. We don't need to use the freaking word sedition.
How does the dictionary define sedition?
Don't care. Mm.
Could you get a synonym for sedition, Peter, maybe in the thesaurus?
That's a different book.
Okay. That's a different book. Peter, you live in Washington. What was your impression? Did you watch the hearing, or were you like Catherine?
No, actually, I was like President Biden, who also didn't watch the hearings. I mean, obviously, he admitted this. Like, I was doing other stuff. So I didn't watch the hearings, but obviously I looked at coverage in advance and afterwards, including our own. Like Catherine, I thought Elizabeth Nolan Brown had a really good take on Friday morning. My impression of the January 6th hearings is you know, sort of has kind of two parts. I don't think it's going to change anyone's mind in the sort of larger sense that Democrats are aiming for here. I won't say, however, that I don't think it will change anyone's mind at all, because, you know, as you said, Matt, as Catherine said, as Elizabeth Nolan Brown wrote, people came in with an expectation that this was just going to be a bunch of grandstanding, and it wasn't. And this ended up being something else. And so I think, you know, Ross Douthat wrote a pretty good column about the hearings over the weekend for The New York Times. And he argued that the committee sort of has two purposes. First, that its job is just to present a thorough accounting of the event of January 6th, right? What happened, how it happened, what the lead up to the riot in the Capitol was, both on the day of January 6th and in the, you know, weeks and months before, you know, all the sort of stop the steal stuff about the election. And there, I think it actually looks like the committee is succeeding, and that seems like a good goal for Congress and for a committee here is to get all of this stuff on record and to put it out there in public view, right? So not only do we get footage of Trump riling up the crowd in advance of the riot, we get raw footage of the event from security cameras, that sort of thing, right? We get a testimony from Trump's inner circle, who we have always thought of as kind of toadies. They're all saying they thought that his claims about the election were total nonsense. They are saying that in real time, Pence was the one who was, doing the job of commander in chief in many ways, whereas Trump was just sort of sitting there saying, maybe our supporters are right about Mike Pence and he deserves to be hanged. But that brings us to the second purpose of the committee, which is it seems designed to make Trump unacceptable in American politics, to rule him out of the American, you know, sort of political system. And here I go back to my skepticism and my cynicism, sort of about whether or not this is going to change anybody's mind. So everybody who has listened to this podcast for the last couple of years knows that I think Trump was a terrible president, that his reaction to clearly losing the election, his attempts to subvert the outcome of the election, just to plant seeds of distrust about the results, have rendered him completely unfit for office. I don't see how you can look at the evidence about January 6th, look at the coverage here, look at what happened in the run-up to January 6th, even before the riot, and think otherwise. But lots of people pretty clearly disagree with me. And if anything, some version of Trump's false stolen election narrative now seems to be an article of faith, maybe not for the whole Republican Party, but for large swaths of it. And I don't see that changing because of the hearing.
Nick, what was your general reaction to the hearing to the extent that you are alive?
Yeah. You know, one thing is that I did watch it because it wasn't another award show that really is well past its prime. So I felt like, you know, and it's not the NHL All-Star game.
How would you rate it versus the Grammys and the Oscars?
Oh, it's much better. You know, the red carpet was also much better, I think.
It had less Adam Schiff than those award shows.
Yeah, no, Adam Schiff is good in everything, though. You know, really. Yeah. He, you know, 10% better when Adam Schiff is there. You know, I'm of two minds, like Peter, but my mind is split in different ways. And one is that I think that the January 6th event has been overblown. And the idea, you know, I mean, we talk about it as a riot. I believe our standing subject header tag at Reason is January 6th riot. I think that's about right. It's bad. The people involved, the people who went inside and caused damage and, you know, havoc and stuff should be, they should be prosecuted, not under sedition. That's insane. And we have a couple of great pieces. From people, not just Liz Brown, but also David Beto and J.D. Tuccilli, talking about how the history of charges of sedition almost never cover people who are actually trying to overthrow the government. It's always used by a relatively weak government to persecute people who, you know, they find challenging and things like that. But, people who cause damage and were fuck-ups, you know, should get in trouble for that. I don't think it was, you know, we weren't minutes away from the government being in charge of the QAnon shaman or something like that, or being led by the QAnon shaman. I do think that the hearings do a function, and this I largely agree with Peter, is that in laying out what Trump and his mostly pathetic minions were doing, there were a number of people there, not least of which is Mike Pence, who were like, you're a fucking idiot. You lost the election. you know, change your diaper and take a nap. Like that's, you know, I mean, that really does need to get through. And I think among people on this podcast, I was the one, I don't think that Donald Trump was, you know, a destroyer of norms or anything, you know, as apocalyptic as his worst critics say. But it's like, when you look at the way that he acted and his insistence, you know, and it started on November 6th, it actually started, you know, before the election in 2016, because he won the 2016 election, but he never fully admitted it because he was still insisting, no, I won a majority of the popular vote, except for, you know, voter fraud and things like that.
There were millions of votes yeah. that were fraudulent, according to Trump, in 2016.
You know, it's good to air the way that he was reacting in real time and stuff like that. I didn't vote for him. I would never vote for him. So it's not going to change my mind. But I think having that out there in the public record is a good thing. I do worry that the January 6th hearings, which is people, and I think this was widely observed, they were not the witch hunts that people expected. But that's what this week is for. Actually, so like when you, I'm looking at Deadline, the website Deadline, where they have a list of what's coming up, you know, on June 13th, June 15th, June 21st. The scripts for these hearings are to show that Donald Trump is the most evil man in the universe and things like that. So I think in the end, this will mostly harden people's position. You know, Matt, we know this from a book that we wrote together. You may not recall it. I do. It was called The Declaration of Independence. And it, you know, there are two dead-ender camps that comprise, each have about a third of Americans in them, you know, conservative Republicans, liberal Democrats. They're not going anywhere. These hearings will harden them in their position. But I do think it will change many people who are in the center, not necessarily moderate or centrist, but they will be like, you know what, like Hillary Clinton, Trump is in the past. We need to get rid of, you know, we need to stop talking about him and thinking about him as a viable future, as a viable identity that's going to inform the political, cultural, or ideological future of this country. And I think they'll do that.
So I actually have a question for Nick on yeah. that. Just like, setting aside the charge of sedition,
right?
Don't you think the timing matters here, right? The day January 6th was chosen for a reason. This was the day the election was going to be certified, right. And the event was held right in the hours leading up to the certification. Mm-hmm. The rioters were there to disrupt the certification of Joe Biden as president. They were there to disrupt the certification of the handover of power.
They weren't there to violently stop anything. I mean, these are people.
Did you see the footage? That was not peaceful. And it was not a peaceful transfer of power because of the rioters and because of the riot. And that to me makes a difference.
But they were there to protest, you know, and I mean, these are people who, you know, we assume are packing guns all the time. They went into the Capitol building. And they, you know, there are very few weapons charges. People weren't carrying weapons with them on the Capitol grounds. So
it was hard to carry weapons inside of Washington, D.C. On purpose. There would have been weapons if there was a different set of protocols.
Wait. A set of protocols, meaning laws. If these people are about to take over the country, I don't think they're going to be like, you know what, but we do have to abide by, you know, the gun laws of, you know, Washington, D.C. That's what I'm getting at. Definitely the riot got out of hand. Some people wanted it to get out of hand. But I don't think, you know, a protest, you know, ultimately was a symbolic protest on the day. Yes, they chose January 6th for a reason. It's not because it's the epiphany, you know, or the celebration of Jesus getting, you know, getting his bris.
To get to your complaint echoed by Nick about the use of the term seditious conspiracy, which is a term, it's a law, right, that we have. That applies to, quote, people who conspire to overthrow, put down, or to destroy by force the government of the United States, or to levy war against them, or to oppose by force the authority thereof, or by force to prevent, hinder, or delay the execution of any law of the United States, or by force to seize, take, or possess any property of the United States contrary to the authority thereof. I heard some words in there that would seem to apply to what the Oath Keepers and Proud Boys, at least as presented in the prosecutorial style. This is our best, you know, case Thursday by Liz Cheney et al. That they conspired to oppose by force and to delay the execution of this transfer of power. So why not charge them under seditious conspiracy, Catherine?
Because I don't think anyone should be, probably. I mean, I think, like, yes, the way, like, one of my big objections to the whole concept of sedition, bringing it in here, is that it probably shouldn't be brought in anywhere if that's the definition. That is too broad of a definition. That includes a far too large scope of action. And, you know, we have a dark history of the use of these laws mistargeted. You know, they are highly political. They're used in a political way. And once used, tend to get used again, that sort of, once they exist, once they're out there, once it is something that people who pull political levers feel that they have available to them, if for no other reason than just as they are being used in this case, to basically throw some extra charges on the top of a tall pile, right? It just makes the list of charges sound scarier and more serious.
20 years scarier,
exactly.
And sandwich of charges.
It's a Dagwood sandwich of charges, and sedition is the olive. I always wondered about that olive. Like, how do you eat it? Anyway, you know, it doesn't lead to kind of rule of law, you know, predictable, understandable behavior on the part of the criminal justice system, which is the relevant entity to be handling these charges. I am a little closer to Peter than Nick in the shouting match that just occurred there. I think the fact that it was on January 6th and that, you know, they clearly intended to disrupt this crucial kind of moment in the peaceful transfer of power matters, but it also matters that they didn't succeed and never were going to, because they're a bunch of jerks who really did not have their act together. Both of those things matter. And I just don't think that in general we should be bandying around seditious conspiracy. I don't think we need to, in this case, to get done the work that needs to get done to convey, hey, don't do this again.
I would just add one little fact here, which is that there was a pipe bomb found at the DNC on January 6th, and that suggests that there were weapons. There was intent by someone, maybe not anyone who was directly involved in rioting at the Capitol, but someone intended and wanted there to be more intense violence on that day. And if the Congress had evacuated 20 minutes later or failed to get their act together to get out of the room, we don't know what would have happened.
I don't think the presence of weapons is necessarily the main thing. I mean, I'm an armed society as a polite society gal. That doesn't extend to pipe bombs, but I do think, you know, in general, we should be very wary again of, you know, this exact behavior, but more people had, say, guns that they were legally licensed to carry on them, that wouldn't necessarily have signaled different intent. That would have signaled a different gun culture. So just worth noting.
I think it's important, too. I mean, if we think of this as a stress test for, you know, American democracy, the big takeaway is that it held. And it doesn't mean like, okay, let's do it again next week or next election or anything, but...
Please, let's not.
Oh, you know, but then again, you know, intermittent workouts, that could be, you know, very healthy.
Nope.
But having said that, that's part of the takeaway should be in all of these things, you know, that the Trump presidency might have embodied as a test to the system. You know, the system held.
One could also argue that the system held just by the actions of a very few people. And if sure. those people would have acted or chose differently, we could be in a much different and scarier place on January 6th and 7th and 8th and 9th and et cetera. I would also add, just to throw some more love in the direction of J.D. Tuchilli, whose last name makes for really great Slack emojis, that he points out, deliciously rather, that the use of seditious conspiracy was suggested as a preventative prosecutorial tool by Bob Barr in November 2020, in advance of supposed or presumed left-wing riots in the face of what would happen if Donald Trump won. This is also something that I think it's worth reminding ourselves about. I remember walking through Manhattan, where Nick Gillespie lives. Whole bunches of it were boarded up, y'all, on election day, because the idea was if Trump wins, the people who live in Manhattan who didn't vote for him might be smashing windows.
That also happened in beautiful, sunny Santa Monica, Matt Welch. A liberal redoubt.
Communist, Nick. There's a difference.
Yeah, it's a People's Republic. One of the things to think about, and put a bookmark in on, or a reminder, what happens come November, because the Democrats, by virtually every accounting, are going to lose big. They are already laying the groundwork for why these elections are not legitimate, because, Republicans all over the country have, kicked people off voter rolls and are going to keep people from voting and this and that and all of that kind of stuff. So it'll be interesting to see what happens in terms of the fake election discourse come the midterms.
That allows us to transition, Peter. Let's let Dr. Ron Paul transition us.
He is an obstetrician.
He had a piece from today with the headline, "Out of Desperation, Democrats Resurrect Insurrection Theater." The opening paragraph goes like this. This week, U.S. gasoline prices hit an average of $5 per gallon, an all-time record. Officially, consumer price inflation hit 8.6% last month compared to last May. That is a four-decade high. In reality, though, inflation is much higher than that, as anyone who works for a living can affirm. Peter, from what I understand, you work for a living, making sense out of economic mumbo-jumbo. How big is our inflation?
So the consumer price index rose 8.6 this last month. That's 8.6% up from a year ago. And that is the highest increase since December 1981. Woo. So if you remember the politics of December 1981, and I have to say I don't remember because I was 2 months old, but I've heard about them. Inflation was a real big deal back then, and it is fixing to be a real big deal in American politics again right now. So core inflation rose about 6%. That basically excludes food and energy. But what are people mad about right now? They're mad about food prices, about going to the grocery store and how expensive things are, which is why Joe Biden is making all of these like weird noises about like subsidizing a new federally owned cow processing plant or something so that like your steak will be cheaper. It's really bizarre. And gas prices are the real pain point here. Fuel oil prices are up 106.7% over the last year. That's an awful lot, right? So there are 9 states, I believe, as of this weekend that have $5 gas prices. I filled my car up over the weekend with $5 gas, I believe, for the first time ever. But also it's expensive to rent and to buy a home right now. So shelter costs are way up. And as a result of all of this, even though worker wages are up as well, and one of the responses here to part of inflation is that employers have had a hard time finding labor, in particular relatively low wage hourly labor, and so they have raised salaries, raised hourly wages in response. But even still, even with pretty significant gains, especially for low wage workers, real wages actually declined 0.6% just from April to May, and 3% on a one-year basis. So low wage workers are on the one hand making more money just in a dollar for dollar sense than before, but they have less spending power just because inflation is taking such a bite out of their paychecks.
Nick, you in December of 1981 were what, 43 years old?
I was a non-traditional college student, Matt. Yeah. I'd gone back after working in coal mines and fighting in Korea.
You were one of the Molly Maguires that Joe Biden keeps talking about.
That's right, yeah. By the way, not Sean Connery's worst movie, but not his best, the Molly Maguires. Mm. It would be better if he was wearing the Zardoz bathing suit throughout.
I mean, I
thought we were going to make it through a whole podcast with no Zardoz.
No,
you tricked me again.
No, we can't, because Zardoz would start reprisals against us. That would be very damaging.
Tell us, Nick, what lessons that you can impart to the younger generation about what the great inflation looked like in American life, politics, and especially Sean Connery movies.
Yeah. One of the things, and Peter, when he says, like, he doesn't remember what inflation was like because he was 2 months old. I was, 19 or something in 1981. And so inflation didn't, it was not in the foreground for me. It's something that you would hear whenever adults got together to talk. You would hear these whispered tones or discussions of things. And the way that it affected people, I think, was both, adults, it was that, it was unemployment, it was a looming sense of doom because the Cold War was slipping away. We had a good run in the 1976 Olympics, but there were like few and far bright spots in most of the 70s and the 80s looked to be just as bad. There was a major recession going on. What inflation does and what was different in the 80s and what might be starting now is that by the time you hit 81, inflation had been significant. It had been basically over 5% for a long time. It had been over 10% at various points. Stagflation was a real thing. And this was kind of, a breaking point, really, in a way that right now we are in the early stages of it, because even the old people like Joe Biden, who doesn't remember that much anymore anyway, but like people have forgotten what it's like to have high levels of inflation sustained throughout time. And it is, more than time, inflation is the thief of hope. It makes everything seem precarious. It makes everything seemed rigged and a scam, and it is one of the most punishing kind of social realities that infects and influences everything. And to me, that is the biggest problem, is that we're in the early stages of this, and we have, in a way, you would think having a government that is run by 800-year-old people, like the Talosians from Star Trek, people who are ancient and can remember back in prehistory, this would be a time where they would use their wisdom to say, we really have to get this under control and we know how to do it. And instead, they are acting as if nothing is wrong, as if, oh, this, it's still temporary. It's still, it's going to pass at any moment. And that should be deeply disturbing for everybody. And it should lead to massive, hopefully peaceful revolts. But like what we need is a government now that understands when you drop so much money through fiscal and monetary policy into the economy in a 2-year period after a 20-year period of absolute lack of restraint of spending and monetary creation, and you don't come up with plans to do anything about it, all that is going to do is lead to more inflation. And, this should be a, it should be a wake-up call. And almost all of us are asleep, actually, to the reality of inflation.
Catherine, aside from being super stoked about being able to accurately use the word stagflation in our style guide in a couple of months, not quite there yet, but at some
point. That's when a stag party gets much, much larger.
Yuck.
That's when the stripper shows up, right?
You have weaponry in the studio there, Catherine, I hope.
I do.
But no, listening to Nick's eloquent layout of the storm ahead and our unpreparedness of it, can us as a political culture right now pass that stress test, do you think?
No, I mean, we have already bound our own hands. We have really limited the tools that we have to deal with this. There's a great piece in the Washington Post this morning. It is not one of the 11 pieces about the January 6th hearings. And the headline on it is Inside Biden's Frustration with Soaring Prices. And,
oh,
he's out and about.
He really is just like us.
Priced out doing little press, press jaunts about Iowa biofuels and then going back to the office and being like, this is a bunch of garbage and this is absolutely not going to touch the real problem. I've been enjoying Larry Summers' I Told You So tour, but also Jason Furman, who has been pretty spot on about a lot of this stuff. And in this Washington Post piece, he says, listen, people are mad about gas prices. Those prices are mostly set globally, and there's not a whole lot that Biden can do about it. And we already spent all the stupid money, both in terms of COVID emergency spending, and then also in terms of the expansion of the monetary supply during the last 2 years. And we have to wait for that to work its way out of the system. And there is a bunch of stuff that could be done. There is, there really are some policy remedies, but they are mostly kind of technical. They're often unpalatable. We need to turn off the spigot of free money. And, we are in the middle of a conversation about doing, for instance, a massive debt forgiveness program, which is not going to help. There's just a bunch of things that politicians have put into their playbook, which are dump a ton of money onto a targeted population, and they have to stop doing that, and they're not going to stop doing that.
All right. We're going to hit our listener email of the week here in a moment. But first, are you feeling burned out, squeezed dry like a sponge, sitting in your chair with a 1,000-yard stare, wondering how you're ever going to get up and go? Many people can be burned out without even knowing it. Symptoms can include lack of motivation, irritability, fatigue, and basically every other emotion and sensation I felt all of yesterday. BetterHelp Online Therapy is there to help those of us who need it and are willing to seek it. BetterHelp is customized online therapy offering video, phone, and even live chat sessions with a neutral party therapist. It's much more affordable than in-person counseling, and you can be matched with a professional in under 48 hours. Roundtable listeners get 10% off their first month. Just go to betterhelp.com/roundtable. That's better H-E-L-P, as what all y'all's 401ks need right now. .com/roundtable. Go there today. You'll be glad you did. Should I check the Yahoo Finance here? Let's just do this. Let's do a spot check here. Hit the refresh button.
This does not constitute financial advice. Please
Thank you for that clarification. As of 11:30 in the morning, the Dow 30 industrial average is down 2.5%, S&P down 3.3%, NASDAQ down 4%. Okay, it's an exciting day. All right, what were we talking about? Yes, reminder, email your terse queries to roundtable@reason.com. This one comes from Jamie Lewis, who you can follow on Twitter at JKL620. Are you a bot, Jamie? Anyway, bot Jamie writes, who is in charge at the White House? Several times we've heard the president make off-the-cuff remarks only to have the White House walk it back afterward. Who's making that call? Who speaks for the White House? Obviously, the president isn't the one running the show. Is our government a reboot of Weekend at Bernie's? Who is the man behind the curtain we are not supposed to pay attention to? How did they get this position? Inquiring minds want to know. Catherine, I will append to bot Jamie's question here. The implied, is this worrying? And also the, does it matter?
Yeah, I was just speaking earlier about politicians kind of going on autopilot on a pre-existing mode in their pre-existing playbook. And I actually think a lot of what is going on, the phenomenon that's described in this question, is that Biden maybe keeps forgetting that he is now the number one guy. And so he can no longer do spicy little trial balloons. Like, that was a thing that Joe Biden was good for a long time, was, you know, when he was like, this is a big fucking deal. And like, what if we gay marriaged and like all these things. And he used to be, that used to be a crucial function that like wacky Uncle Joe provided. But wacky Uncle Joe is now the patriarch. He's now the godfather. He's now whatever other male relative you want him to be. And he can't be doing that. And so I think the most charitable interpretation, which is one I'm open to, is that there is no man behind the curtain. There is no like Karl Rove, Dick Cheney type character. I think it's just Joe Biden saying shit. And then Joe Biden going back to his desk and being like, ugh, tell him I didn't mean it. Or, you know, the people around him being like, did you mean it? And him being like, I don't know, did I? And they're like, you did not. And he's like, okay, I did not. Right. And presidents have advisors. Like, that's a perfectly normal thing. I don't love, actually, the stereotype of the, you know, I mean, this was sort of the vision of like Bill Clinton and to some extent Barack Obama, this sort of savant who has at his fingertips the, you know, every policy detail, who is encyclopedic, who is himself just like birthing all of the policies full formed from his head. I'm sorry.
I got it.
I would rather, you know, have a bunch of kind of sober committee men getting together and talking about these things, given the available options. But yeah, I think Joe Biden just keeps forgetting he's not the fun vice president uncle.
Peter, there was a piece of reporting a couple of weeks ago where Biden was specifically frustrated at this. He's like, I'm the president. Why do they keep walking me back? I can say it. Can't I say so? I'm the president. I can say stuff like that. You live in Washington, Peter. What's your answer to the Weekend at Bernie's question?
I'm not old enough to remember December 1981, but I do remember September 2020. And the Democratic primary debate in which Joe Biden practically pounded the podium and said, I am the Democratic Party right now. And that's true in the sense that it's always the case that the president becomes the front person, right? Like for a political party, right? Like, so even if you think of a political party like a band, right? And everybody's got, you know, like the keyboard player is actually pretty important there and really plays a big role behind the scenes. When they go on stage and they perform live, the singer is the one who's actually talking to the audience most of the time and is serving as the front person. The singer is the band in a sense, even if there's a bunch of other stuff going on. And Joe Biden is the Democratic Party in that sense. But there's a reverse sense in which the opposite is true. And this is a point that I've made before, but Biden is in some ways even more than most presidents serving as a kind of just as a barometer for the Democratic Party, and in particular for the professional class, right? He's like, there's a sense in which he's like a composite character in a memoir, you know, and you read these memoirs at the beginning, they're like, some of these events have been rearranged. And also some of these characters are actually stand-ins for like three or four different people. Well, Biden is like, the Biden presidency is a composite of the Democratic professional apparatus, which is made up of a whole bunch of kind of Beltway Washington lifers, but also of a bunch of representatives of activist interest groups. And so the Biden presidency keeps being hemmed in and keeps being run, in a sense, by these people who are just these sort of activist Democratic lifers, a little bit more than the actual president is running the show. And that's always true in some sense, just in the, because the president, you know, no president, even the sort of smartest, most savanty, wonky president, can do everything. But the president should be hearing from these people and then making decisions. And it kind of sounds like those people are hearing from the president and making their own decisions. And that is a little bit worrying sometimes.
Nick, I mostly want you to answer this question through the prism of
lead singers,
movies.
Oh,
lead singers, other move being there, right? We used to have that one during the Reagan presidency.
Well, we're in at least the second term of Chauncey Gardner, right?
Yeah.
If Trump was the first term, Biden, you know, it's one more set of bit of continuity that we have an idiot in the White House who most of the time doesn't mean what they say and doesn't say what they mean, right? So, I mean, to go with lead singers, I was thinking, Peter. As Peter was talking, that Biden is like Liam Gallagher, you know, who thinks he's speaking for the band Oasis, but then there's people behind him who are actually writing everything.
Man, I wrote an Amtrak from New York to D.C. with him and his band once, and they had to whip out multiple credit cards to pay their bar bill at the end because they couldn't do it at all on a single transaction.
Is that because like his finances are hard or that?
No, because they ran up such a big alcohol bill that the Amtrak system could not figure out how to process it all at once. And this is in a 3-hour trip.
Imagine the series of life choices that leads you to that moment. Oh,
no, let's not shift the blame from Amtrak. I took the train down from New York. I'm in D.C. right now.
I don't even know how you run up a tab, but I definitely witnessed this happen, right? Like, you have to pay for everything when you buy it.
I would rather that Liam Gallagher was in charge of the U.S. government then, because at least he's paying the tab at the end of the trip. But Amtrak has like 3/4 of the trip was like had no Wi-Fi. And it's kind of like, how is that happening in this late day and age? In any case, with Biden, I'm not totally convinced that he's more out over his skis or whatever shitty metaphor you want to use than other presidents. But it really does kind of reaffirm the idea that this guy is, you know, he's not all there. If we agree that Donald Trump showed signs of cognitive decline while in office, or certainly between his 80s and 90s appearances on the Howard Stern show and what we got in the White House, Biden is as bad or worse. And more importantly, and this goes back to the inflation question and other things, Biden does not seem to have any sense of what he's doing and why. And this is, you know, this is a moment where a lot of things could get done and we could, you know, close off a lot of negative things, such as inflation, such as foreign policy disasters that are brewing that might embroil the U.S. in really bad wars again. And Biden just does not seem to have a vision for the country or what he's going to do next. And that's deeply, deeply disturbing. It's deeply problematic. And unfortunately, this is where he is kind of like the country itself, because, you know, we're going into a midterms. And again, I'm talking about how the Republicans are going to have a great midterm election. We have zero idea of what kind of legislative agenda they have. Biden's agenda is kind of soft and gooey, and it changes a little bit, you know, et cetera. But like, you know, this is not good. There is nobody driving the car. I don't think American society is a car, and it shouldn't, you know, we shouldn't be driving in one direction. But the government, you know what, like right now, it's pretty rudderless.
I think that there is an obvious Republican agenda, and that is no more drag queen story hour at Disney. I just am fixated now because of you people of Liam Gallagher either being in charge of Amtrak or the next president. and I think his Twitter game is right up there next to Trump's. I mean, he really certainly a lot better than old Joe Biden's. All right. I wanted to
Fact-checking purposes, I should probably say I have not fact-checked that story. And I was a witness like from feet away. It's possible I was misunderstanding what was going on.
Nah.
Weak sauce. Weak asterisk sauce on that story.
Why? No. Why would you just insert a doubt into it? Anyways, let's go to a quick round here. We had elections in this country, more than a half a dozen states. Last Tuesday, most news headline grab-worthy-ish happening from California, where San Francisco DA Chesa Boudin was decisively recalled. Let's just go round the table here and everybody bring one answer to this question, which is, what did we learn during last Tuesday's elections? Catherine, do you want to start?
Honestly, I didn't learn anything from the elections. Here's what I learned. Mitch Daniels is stepping down as president of Purdue University. And I, for like one moment, was like, Mitch Daniels is coming to save us. No, he's not. He's just, really? He's 73. So speaking of the gerontocracy.
So he's young.
He's has younger than everyone with actual power in this country, but not actually. He's probably not going to begin his campaign. So screw the elections. I care only about Mitch Daniels. And he is now a free agent. I guess there's a little bit of hope in my heart.
Chuck Grassley in Iowa he won his GOP primary with 74% of the vote. He's 88. He's running for his, you know, 1,000th term. So Mitch Daniels, come on. Like
our former Reason employee, Michael Moynihan, reminded me last night that Bullet Bob Dornan is still alive, which is he's right up there on Chuck Grassley's age. Nick, what is the thing that you learned from last Tuesday?
So, you know, I kind of was looking at California more broadly than just the Chesa Boudin story. Nancy Rommelman was there in San Francisco covering the recall election for Reason. And I highly recommend reading her stuff at Reason and at Paloma Media, as well as a video interview I did with her that's up on YouTube and at Reason.com last week. But more broadly, there is a sign that California is going through something, or the beginning, a temblor, Matt, of a shakeup in the Golden State, because Rick Caruso, who's an L.A. billionaire, who's running for mayor of L.A., he won. You know, they have those the primaries where the top two people go on to the to the finals. Caruso won that over Democratic Representative Karen Bass. So you might see a Republican, nominally Republican, governor or mayor of L.A., and also Lonnie Chen, who won 37%. She's a Republican running for state comptroller. She won the primary in that, which might give California its first statewide Republican, since Schwarzenegger, who barely a Republican. But that, California is a supermajority Democratic state. I know, Matt, you write about that a lot, et cetera. You are starting to see shakeups in a place like California, which makes total sense. Gavin Newsom won his primary for, it's all open primaries, but he won easily. But he has presided over a state that saw year-over-year decline in population in 2020, losing a congressional seat in, going out this time. I think there's a sense that California may start to fracture in a way that becomes genuinely interesting. The Boudin recall election certainly signals that, as did the San Francisco school board elections. What is interesting, though, too, and this kind of throws some cold water there in this thesis, there were at least two incumbent Republican congresspeople from California who not only didn't win their primaries, meaning they go on in an open primary, they go on against the second vote getter in the general. It's not even clear that they came in second yet because they were challenged by Trump people. So in any case, California, I don't think it's the bellwether. I don't think it's the harbinger of things to come necessarily. But what we're seeing in California are shifts that are fascinating because, you know, we have had 20 years of terrible politics, particularly in California, and to see any kind of shattering of that or shaking it up a little bit, I think is a good sign that we'll move into a different era that hopefully will be less shitty than this one.
Special shout out to the Los Angeles County, I presume, Board of Elections. 6 days after the election, as of this morning, they had still only counted 73% of the vote there. So I think it's time for Liam Gallagher to be named the board chair of elections in the great city of Los Angeles. Peter, what did you learn from last Tuesday?
So I wasn't actually looking at a race last Tuesday, but one that was very recent, and that is the Republican primary in Georgia. And in two crucial races, Georgia voters went for candidates who said no thanks to Trump's stolen election nonsense. Those races are the Republican nomination for governor, where Brian Kemp beat David Perdue. Kemp was a big target of Trump on Twitter. And then also the GOP nomination for Secretary of State. Secretary of State, of course, being the person who has to certify elections or electors in political races, where Brad Raffensperger beat Jody Heiss. I think this is good news for people who would like to see American politics move beyond Trump, who want to see his self-serving lies about the 2020 election sort of rebutted not just by Democrats and anti-Trump Republicans in Congress, but also by voters and who want to see people move on. And it brings to mind a focus group of Republican voters done by Reason friend Kristen Soltis Anderson recently, where she was talking to Republican voters about how they felt about Trump. And her takeaway was, you know, these folks are not anti-Trump, and they might vote for Trump if it were Trump versus Biden in a 2024 election. But they're also not deeply devoted to him. They don't feel like he is the only guy that who they could ever vote for. Like he is the whole party and they would just follow him if he left or the party split or moved on. And I do think that there's some wisdom and insight in that. And you can see it in the Georgia Republican primaries from a couple of weeks ago.
All right, let's go to our end of podcast, what we have been consuming in the cultural sphere. Catherine, do you want to lead us off?
Yeah, so I went on Facebook, which I had not done in a rather long time for personal, like I go obviously to check out Reason's page and for work, but I went and looked at my personal Facebook page and an old friend noted her incredible enthusiasm about having just received in the mail a book. And that book was W.E.B. Du Bois' Data Portraits. Turns out my man W.E.B. Du Bois also just like an infographics dude. And for the Paris Exposition in 1890, he made a series of genuinely beautiful and way ahead of their time data visualizations about the state of Black America, especially about the kind of financial and professional condition of Blacks in Georgia. And it is fascinating. It is beautiful. The book itself is beautiful. I think it's Princeton Architectural Press. So it's just got that like nice paper and beautiful color. But just some like bold data visualization choices that would still set Twitter afire today. And a ton of really interesting information that is the correct level of granular. He's basically looking at data from the, you know, immediately pre-Civil War period through his present. And a lot happened to Black Americans in that time, to say the least. This is probably one of my most like off-topic recommendations ever. But my enthusiasm for this book was so great that my children told me I was being weird. So that's what I have to say about it. It just is like really very cool if this is your type of thing. W.E.B. Du Bois' Data Portraits, Visualizing Black America.
What I just about called you Eric, Nick. I don't know. I think Eric is better. Okay. Eric Gillespie, Dr. Eric.
So I don't want to say because we have a staff member named Eric, but it's really one of the worst names.
and an intern. We now have two Erics.
I mean, and you know, I don't know if it's better or worse with a K. The
no,
CH.
The
I mean, let's not even talk about it. Yeah, that's the worst. But I was going to suggest, I think I might buy the book that Catherine just recommended. I had read Du Bois, The Philadelphia Negro, which is one of his earliest works that does that for Philadelphia's 7th Ward, where he maps every black business, residence, et cetera. And it's fantastic. I mean, he was trained in sociology. And when you look at that kind of granular stuff, it's really fascinating. Certainly better than his, which I also recommend people read at least once a year, his obituary for Stalin, which is just unbelievably insane. It's so terrible. But having said that, as a prologue, I watched Keep Sweet, Pray and Obey, which is a limited series on Netflix from Rachel Dretson and Grace McNally. Dretson is probably best known, or to me anyway, as the director of Far From the Tree, a fantastic documentary based on Andrew Solomon's book of the same name about people who have parents who have children that are very different from them. You know, it's short. Little people having full-size kids, straight people having gay kids, et cetera. I mean, it's a fantastic work. And Grace McNally, who produced a documentary about gerrymandering in Michigan called Slay the Dragon. Keep Sweet, Pray and Obey is about the Warren Jeffs coven of fundamentalist Mormons who continue to have polygamy. And what is fantastic about it is it's a, you know, it's a very dark look at a community that presents itself as this is part of a religious tradition that is family oriented, et cetera. But it's actually, when you look at it, it is really about the absolute suppression and control of female sexual desire. And it is child abuse. I think most people walking away from it would do this. There was a documentary that came out about a decade ago that looked at the cost of that community, this particular group, on young men who are effectively shut out from marrying and be, you know, participating in community. This is overdue in the sense that it talks about the women and the girls often who are put in this. It's on Netflix. It's doing, you know, boffo business at Netflix. It's a really great documentary about a dark subculture that I think a lot of people who are interested in alternative culture. This is the point where interest in pluralism and tolerance, like you reach a line where you have to say, is this okay? Because effectively, the people in this community are barred from a right of exit. You have to escape. So if you, you know, it's similar in that sense to Scientology, and that it, from a libertarian perspective, what's interesting is that some of it is physical, but most of it is mental. So I think it's an interesting challenge and a harrowing, you know, memorable documentary.
Peter, what have you been consuming?
Like a lot of moviegoers, I watched Jurassic World Dominion. So I love the original Jurassic Park. I think it's kind of the ultimate summer movie in so many ways, even more so than Jaws, even more so than Star Wars. It just sort of defines what a summer popcorn blockbuster should be. And I more or less tolerate most of the sequels, even if I don't really love any of them. But the new one is so bad. It's so bad in so many ways, like just like all the ways. It looks crappy. It is lazy and nonsensically plotted. It brings back a bunch of old characters and gives us some new ones. And all of them are just boring and uninteresting. They don't have anything or fun or like notable to do. The characters brought back from the original Jurassic Park, the 93 version, mostly just seem sort of old, right? Like they're sort of like, what are you doing here, folks?
I guess they lost their congressional reelections, right?
Yeah, right. No, this is in fact the point I'm about to make, right? Like in lieu of actually having any good ideas, anything worth watching, the movie seems to kind of know that it doesn't have any good tricks up its sleeve. So it just sort of substitutes like a really pathetic and desperate form of nostalgia, including a sequence at the end that is practically a remake of the big T-Rex set piece from the middle of the first Jurassic Park, which I think is in many ways the best summer blockbuster set piece ever made, right? You can still remember all of those beats, all of those images, starting with, you know, the T-Rex foot kind of squishing into the mud, and then, you know, the big roar, right, that happens almost exactly at the middle of the movie. It's so effective, all right? It's so memorable that that movie just burns images into your brain, and it's great, still works today. And this whole movie is just sort of like, hey, remember that? You loved that. And I think there probably is a lesson here for American politics, just in the sense that American politics is also bereft of good ideas at this point, and it is filled with old, sad characters from decades past who aren't really doing anything worthwhile, just hoping that you're happy to see them again. And it just leans so heavily on a kind of sad nostalgia, hoping that that nostalgia will pay off for a little bit longer. And in Jurassic World, I mean, I don't think the movie works. Critics hated it, but it did make a ton of money. And so maybe that's also, unfortunately, a lesson for American politics that we are going to see a little bit more of this because it keeps on working.
We didn't love any of these people. Did we love Joe Biden in the summer of 93? I think not, sir.
I think some people had fond feelings for Joe Biden, or at least felt like he was going to be a return to a pre-Trump kind of 90s Clinton style politics that a lot of people didn't find too awful, and that there was going to be something tolerable or even sort of refreshingly like boring there. And we got something else instead.
Did Wayne Knight, TV Seinfeld, make a reappearance? He was eaten to great laughter in the first movie.
Sadly, he remains dead. There is, however, an extended callback to that sequence as well, the sequence in which he dies. And it's just, again, it's just like, why are you remaking the good scenes from the original, but badly?
Yeah.
So I went this past week to the Home Educators Association of Virginia, homeschoolers, basically, annual conference. They've been doing this since the early 80s, and at the exhibition hall, which is just kind of weird and wonderful and filled with people doing all kinds of fun entrepreneurial stuff, guy was selling a game called the Entrepreneur Game. And it's great, y'all. I bought one. So it bills itself as the world's first and only STEM-accredited educational entrepreneur board game teaching investing, marketing, budgeting, negotiating, business life, literacy, and social skills. For kids 12 and up. I played it with my 7-year-old. So, you know, but she's precocious 7-year-old. And she loves it so much. They started off with like, you have to decide whether you're going to have a home-based business or a brick and mortar business. And depending on that, you go into sort of different tracks and you might need to take a loan from a bank for this, but then you have to pay off like this. And at some point she did a hostile takeover of my brick and mortar business and ended up winning. And I'm not happy about that still. There's going to be rematches played, but it's kind of great. You retain lawyers or you don't. I'm going to put money in my marketing account over here, constantly making decisions. And you have to come up with plausible sounding businesses. The people assembled around who are playing have to go, yeah, okay, Coco's Cupcakes. That sounds like a legit home-based business. I can understand where that's coming from. And there's a provision there too. If you end the game, because at the end of the game, everyone goes to the finish line and you liquidate your assets and see who has the most. And if you get like $1 million there, then everyone else has to say to the millionaire, something along the lines of, you are a mogul and your acumen is fantastic. And the guy who invented the game is telling me that, but by far the most controversial rule in that, because people hate it, getting their noses rubbed into their defeat. But anyways, it's a fun game, the Entrepreneur Game. It's by EE Speaks is the name of the company that does it. You can get it on Amazon. We'll throw a link up. And it's just fun. It scratches that itch. My wife has been saying forever that Reason needs to do stuff for kids, you know, and I always find that stuff, notion to be somewhat dodgy. Don't like the proselytization on the youths when it comes to politics necessarily, but just for like, you know, how to start a business and think about stuff and also do a bunch of math. Pretty great for that. So the Entrepreneur Game, check it out. All right. That's all the board games that we have time for. However, I wanted to make sure that we mentioned before we close that there's a Reason Speakeasy coming up featuring the great but shaved not overall body shape, as far as we know, but we're not going to judge about that. Nick, can you tell us about
you
got to
buy
Doherty?
A ticket. You got to buy a ticket to find out whether or not Reason senior editor Brian Doherty, who is going to be talking about his new book, Dirty Pictures, A History of Underground Comics, in New York City on Monday, June 20th. We also have Steve Heller joining us, who worked for the New York Free Press way back in the day in Screw Magazine before kind of becoming legit and working at the New York Times Book Review and becoming a legend in not just design circles, but underground culture in New York. Culture will be joining Brian and myself to do a live taping of the Reason interview at Caveat Theater on Monday, June 20th. Tickets are $10 to touch Brian's perhaps shaven skin. That'll cost extra, and that'll be negotiated, I guess, by your daughter, Matt, who will probably already have that business up and running after a couple more rounds of Entrepreneur Board Game. Go to reason.com/events to get information on the Reason Speakeasy on June 20th, Monday, with Brian Doherty.
And go to reason.com/podcast to get the Reason interview with Nick Gillespie, the Soho Forum debate series, and of course, this very podcast, the Reason Roundtable podcast, every Monday. Thank you for listening. If you like our stuff in general, as a foundation, as a 501c3 nonprofit, go to reason.com/donate. Give us the money. Why not? All right. We'll see you next week and talk about various things. Goodbye.